Hey friends, Backlog is an all-in-one project and code management tool development teams have been waiting for. With project management, bug tracking, wikis, and Git rolled into one easy-to-use platform, Backlog provides the powerful features that development teams need under a clean UI that anyone can use. You can easily onboard your whole team and start working on tasks in minutes. Additional features like Gantt and burden-down charts make it easy to manage projects. Mobile apps keep your team connected and simple pricing scales with you so you can stop worrying about per-user charges. Build your next project with Backlog. Get a 30-day obligation-free trial at backlog.com/Hanselminutes. That's backlog.com/Hanselminutes. Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes. Today I'm talking with Clyde W. Ford. He is the author of Think Black. This is a fantastic book, and he's been running all over the country talking about it, and now he's going to talk to us today. I'm looking at an amazing picture here, sir, is a picture of your dad on the steps of IBM with what looks like about 20 middle-aged white folks, two women. And your dad's in the back there, kind of like giving us the side eye through history. What's going on here?
Yeah, this was a picture, Scott. And first, thank you for inviting me on this podcast. This was a picture of my dad taken in the early 1950s, not long after he became the first black software engineer hired by IBM. He was actually hired by IBM in 1946, went to work in 1947 for the company, and worked there for 37 years. What I found particularly interesting about this picture, and didn't really get to it until it had been published in the book, is to look at where the eyes of everybody are looking. If you see that, my dad and the women are all looking away, and all of the other men in the picture are looking directly at the camera, almost as if to say, I belong, while my dad and the women are kind of questioning whether they do belong in that frame.
Yeah, it is an interesting, awkward thing. Like, you know, you don't know what to read into and what not to read into when you look at a photograph like this. Why are people positioned where they are? You know, your dad and the women are all kind of together within a foot of each other. Your dad's in the back. Maybe it's by height. Maybe it's race. Who knows? But there is a certain sense of like, here's all these people that work at IBM, and then also these two other people that are being effectively othered.
Yeah. And you don't know. You're absolutely right. And I think that questioning is exactly what this book was all about for me, trying to better understand the times when my dad was hired at the company and what that meant for him as a black man, what that meant for me as his son, who later went to work for the company.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Trying to understand what these things are when we're living in 2020, it's an exercise in historical empathy. You know, we go and we see movies like Hidden Figures, and we think what it must be like, but we only spend 2 hours watching a movie like that. And we see one or two awkward things where, you know, Taraji Henson in Hidden Figures is asked to get some coffee, and she has to assert her right to be there. And then you say, oh, wow, that was awful. And then you leave the movie, and then it's over. But he spent
37 years.
37 years. Yeah. Like, was it like that 365 days? Oh, you know, was there ever a safe space? Was ever a moment in, you know, how many years, 10, 20 years, do you get to go in and feel like you belong?
Yeah, and I think that's a great question. And I think the answer is yes. There were obviously times when the prejudice that he did face wasn't right in his face. And so there was that opportunity to relax or at least feel comfortable in what he was doing. Look, my dad did things like he actually maintained the data division of the first ever COBOL compiler. Mm-hmm. And I can remember times when he was quite proud of doing something like that. He took me down, for example, to do memory checks on an IBM 708. And mm-hmm. Boy, in those days, you know, here you have 2K of memory occupying a half a city block, and a memory check took all weekend. Whereas now, we do a memory check of a gig in less than a couple of milliseconds. So there were times when I think my dad was relaxed, enjoyed what he did, recognized what he was doing, mm-hmm. was being important. But there were also times when he really had to fight to maintain his position and to try to make some inroads into change at a company which, like many companies of the day, were resistant to the diversity and inclusion that they even said they were all about.
What were the qualifications? How would this even start? Like, I have a pretty good idea of how I would get my sons into software or hardware today. It would probably start with an undergraduate degree of some kind, depending on whether they were interested in going beyond that. So there's a barrier there. But also just natural, inclination. But I'm trying to imagine in the 40s, as he's growing up and preparing himself, did he have a natural mind for the logic of the time of computers, or was it math? What was the thing that he had that let him do that?
Yeah, and that's, again, a great question. Back in the early, in the middle 40s, late 40s, even when I was hired at IBM, you couldn't go and get a computer science degree. So the question is, how did you prepare? I don't think my dad prepared for a career in computers. That wasn't even on the table in his mind. He prepared for a career in accounting. Computers at the dawn of the digital age were basically split into two tracks. One was a scientific track, and the other was a commercial business track. The commercial and business track really focused on early computers taking over the accounting functions of a business. So consequently, if you were looking for somebody to work with early computers, you were looking for somebody who was really good at business, and in particular at accounting. That's what my dad went to school for at City College in New York, and that's where Watson found him.
Ah, so when we say Watson found him, Thomas Watson from IBM found your dad?
Absolutely. My dad actually met Watson because his accounting professor invited him by her house for dinner, I believe. And what my dad said many times was he walked into her apartment and was surprised by Thomas Watson stepping out and offering him a job, but saying very clearly to my dad, look, I'm the only person in this company who could offer you this job.
Wow. So would it be fair to say that Thomas Watson flexed and kind of offered his, lent his privilege to make that happen?
Yeah, I think my dad had that sense. Whether Watson was doing it because he knew he was conveying that privilege to my dad, or whether there was an ulterior motive behind it, that I really question and write about in the book. But as far as my dad was concerned, Watson was acting as his hero or his champion. And I think for many years, my dad felt there was some protection gained from that.
Mm. I've talked about this with my mentorship groups where we feel that the term mentorship goes beyond when it becomes sponsorship, and that for real change and for real opportunities to happen, it's great to have a mentor, but to have a sponsor is someone to bring you into a room and then let you shine once you're in that room.
Yeah. Now, again, whether Watson really was my dad's sponsor or was a very savvy businessman who understood the public relations value of hiring African Americans and Jews shortly after World War II, that I question. But there's no question about it that it was Watson's word that allowed my dad to get hired at a time when blacks really weren't hired in the technology field. My dad was the second African American hired by IBM, the first as a software or a systems engineer, as they called them in those days.
Mm-hmm. And the other gentleman was a salesperson, right?
That's right. That was T.J. Laster, who was hired as just a couple of months before my dad as a salesman.
Yeah, you make the assertion, and I've heard you make this assertion, that your dad is or may be the first black software engineer in America at the time, given, of course, that it's hard to decide what was a software person when the titles really didn't exist.
Yeah. And again, it's an interesting question, and it is an assertion I make. The truth of the matter is, Scott, is saying that my dad was a software engineer in 1949 is somewhat of an anachronism, because there was no software. In 1947, when he was hired, there was no software then. My dad was hired to work on IBM's first programmable computers, for which there was no software. Yes, there were card readers, But you didn't write a program on cards. Cards were only used for data in those early days of computing. My dad, however, worked on machines like the 407, which again was IBM's first commercially available programmable computer. Eventually, that hardware gave rise to software. And as I said earlier, my dad was right there at the beginning of that process, doing things like maintaining the data division of the first COBOL compiler. So in that regard, my dad was the first African-American involved in software within IBM. And so I think it's a fair bet to say he was the first Black software engineer in America.
That's fantastic. One of the things that is overwhelming to me as I try to look into history is how are these, and forgive me if this is a dumb question, but how are these computers even useful? Like an IBM, 705 had a disk drive with 60K of data on a drive. What would you even do with that?
Yeah, and so 407 didn't even have a disk drive. All it had was a card reader, a typewriter head, and a drawer which you literally used a patch cord to control how the circuitry worked. And basically, I mean, one of the things on the commercial side they used that for was accounting, just straight accounting. That 407 could add numbers and print out results faster than a human could, and with more accuracy as well, too. One of the first uses of this type of what used to call unit record or card reading, punched card equipment, really was for counting people in the census. And that's really how the digital revolution started at the turn of the century. So the idea of counting, anything you could count, tabulate, sort, control, that's what the early computers did. And that's really what their basis was in the commercial field. Now, in the scientific field, those early computers, there were two principal uses. One was in, believe it or not, early weather prediction, and the other was in the military with anything those early computers could do, for example, to compute bomb trajectories or missile trajectories, things like that. My dad didn't work on that side of the business. My dad worked on the commercial end.
Mm-hmm. And just for folks who are listening really closely to understand the scope of this, 705 with 20K of memory has 1/500,000th the memory capacity of an 8 GB smartphone. And an 8 GB smartphone, a typical smartphone, is almost 2 million times faster than what was the top-of-the-line computer at the time, correct?
That is correct. And just to add to that, Scott, a 705 with all the attendant disk drives and tape drives and tabulators and sorters, you could get a computer room that was probably on the order of 10 tons or more. Compare that to your cell phone that's, not even 10 ounces, and you get some sense of the size and change that's happened over the past couple of decades.
Yeah, it's so important. I feel like computer science history isn't taught enough. I hope that your book ends up being taught in schools, because I feel like there's such an assumption as my 11-year-old picks up a pocket supercomputer and puts it in his back pocket and wanders off to play Angry Birds. The idea that we're standing on the shoulders of giants is it isn't even a big enough phrase to express how much power we have in computing compared to what we did back in the day.
Yes, and I think that's one of the things also my dad and his IBM colleagues recognized, is how tremendous what they were doing would be for the future. I think where they may have not understand what they were doing for the future is how, well, they were also unleashing a technological monster that in the wrong hands could be used in ways that they might not have even predicted.
Well, and you pointed out that one of the first uses was the census, counting people. And we might be listening to this podcast and thinking, well, counting people, that's a pretty straightforward and staid kind of a thing to do. But one of the first uses of computers has in itself embedded questions of ethics and, software itself being a political entity. Counting people sounds harmless, but it depends on how you go about it.
Absolutely. And so one of IBM's first ever large-scale projects was counting people for the Eugenics Record Office, run out of Cold Springs Harbor, New York, who were engaged in a project to count people and to discriminate people they were counting on the island of Jamaica so they could separate out mixed-race individuals from pure Europeans for forced sterilization, and other means of population control. IBM software, well, it wasn't software then, IBM hardware in the form of punch cards and punch cards equipment was used to really make that Jamaica study a success. And that began a process, Scott, where IBM and its hardware and other unit record punch card equipment was used, for example, in Nazi Germany, later in South Africa. And so you do get this sense that just because you can count people, that always isn't necessarily a good thing, depending on who's doing the counting and trying to make the discrimination. And unfortunately, IBM's equipment was involved in some of the worst uses of counting people that we can imagine in the 20th century.
Does your dashboard design engage users and set your product apart? According to the analyst firm Gartner, the look and feel of embedded analytics has a direct impact on how end users perceive your application. Fortunately, you don't need to be a professional designer to turn flat information into rich visualizations. Logi Analytics has compiled 17 design tips that will transform your dashboards. Logi Analytics is the leading development platform for embedded dashboards and reports, and unlike other solutions, Logi gives you complete control to create your own unique analytics experience. Visit Logi Analytics, that's L-O-G-I, analytics.com/Hanselminutes to access 17 easy changes that will transform your dashboards. That's L-O-G-I, analytics.com/Hanselminutes. It brings up very, very difficult ethical questions today because we are talking about facial recognition. If I go and do something as simple as make an open source blog and put it out there and it turns into the most popular blog to be spreading hate, then, you know, one person might say, well, hey, free software, this is the whole point. I can't control, you know, here's a gun. I can't control what direction someone points it. But it's interesting that even the very, very first computer programs out there can be used for good or used for evil, just as I suppose a brick could be as well.
Yes, and I think that's important. You know, we talked earlier about how in computers we don't have always that sense of history. It's not just in terms of these wonderful technological developments we don't have that history. We don't have that history of how this wonderful technology was used. And so consequently, I see time and time again, people who don't understand that history recreating some of the very ethical challenges that computers began with back in the 20s and through the 30s and 40s and 50s, as I said, in eugenics, the Holocaust, and apartheid. I'll just give you one simple example, and really, you just pick up the newspaper and you see it every day. There was an educational game on slavery, supposedly, released several years ago called Slave Tetris. And part of this game was you drop slaves into the hold of a slave ship and you move them back and forth to try to pack them tightly. Now, I don't know who in their right mind would release a game like that, but it was released and the people who released it thought they were doing something positive. Well, there was a huge outcry, obviously, and eventually that game was pulled. But it's ideas like this where you fail to understand how technology is actually applying itself to various groups. I think it's really important to kind of understand the history of where this technology has been used and sometimes not for the best uses.
Yeah, indeed. It's important for us to understand historical context when we do something as small as write a little piece of software.
Yeah, and I'll just give you another example. Just a couple of days ago, I was reading about Google's attempt to improve its facial recognition software by taking small video cameras on, you know, smartphones into homeless shelters, singling out black men, because as we know, there's been a problem with how facial recognition software deals with people of dark skin. But Google didn't tell these men what they were using these video recordings for, often didn't even tell them they were making video recordings, and then were trying to use that to improve their facial recognition software. You know, that is another example of how a company might even be well-meaning, but doesn't understand the historical context of how technology has been used against civil and human rights. And now committing an act which I think any rational person sitting down talking to them would say, wait a minute, there's got to be a better way to do this. You're not going about it the right way.
Right. In that example where the larger goal, make facial recognition and make, you know, whether it be Google Photos or whatever they're working on, work better for people with dark skin, certainly a laudable and correct goal. And then all the way down to the leaf nodes, having the street team, which are being paid $5 a head to just hunt down folks and take their picture without letting them know, totally a perversion of the ultimate correct goal.
Absolutely. And again, historically, that goes back, for example, to right after 9/11, when IBM, attempting to improve its Watson facial recognition technology, used video recordings from the New York City Police Department without the knowledge of the individuals they were using those recordings in an attempt to get their software to better discriminate based on race. And that goes back to the uses of software to discriminate based on race, for example, in South Africa, which goes back to the use of hardware and punch cards to discriminate based on race in Nazi Germany, which goes back right to eugenics. So I think my point is that we need to understand the line and the history of the line that we can draw between the earliest somewhat perverted uses of software and today, so that those of us involved in this industry can make sure that things like this don't happen.
Mm-hmm. I want to shift a little bit to talk about what you start talking about in Chapter 10, which is when W.E.B. Du Bois talks about the concept of double consciousness.
Yes.
Which also could be applied to modern day code switching, which is the idea of being of two minds, of two places, not knowing where you belong. You know, mm-hmm. Your father is black at home with his family. Is he also black only when he's at work? What is his position at work? How does he move between these spaces?
Yeah. And again, it's a great point to bring up. And I think one of the challenges of what it means or what it meant to my father to be the first black software engineer at IBM in America, there was this tremendous pressure on the outside that he was, quote, somehow representing his race. I heard that phrase so many times growing up, I can't tell you. And it was both an honor and an incredible burden, because my dad felt that somehow everything he did would be looked at under a microscope of the fact that he had dark skin. And as he began to realize that he wasn't going to get the promotions he deserved, maybe he wasn't going to, maybe he's going to be forced actually to train people who would later become his supervisors, instead of looking to the outside world and saying, hey, there's something not right here, my dad often turned that view inside and said, I guess what's happening to me is because I'm black. And there was this almost self-loathing of his skin color as a human being that he began to develop. He started to read books about Arthur Murray and that whole movement of intelligence and race. And even though those books were debunked, he still believed it, that somehow this helped him better understand what was happening to him. You know, Du Bois talked about this as double consciousness. We talk about it as internalized racism, code switching. There are a number of different ways to look at this, but the fundamental underlying issue here is that as an African American, my dad was turning the racism he experienced in the outside world inside and thinking that he was the problem, even though he was an incredibly intelligent man, on the IBM championship chess teams for a number of years, played four instruments, was an operatic baritone, was working in this incredible field in high tech, still that basic idea that he was less competent, less capable, less intelligent because of his skin color crept into who he was and became an issue that really was quite a challenge for me to bridge with him and became a source of conflict between us.
So when we talk about imposter syndrome, and if you apply what we think about as technology imposter syndrome to that, you know, to Du Bois's concept of double consciousness, you are always questioning yourself and trying to find your own center as you navigate spaces.
Absolutely. And I think certainly my dad, as an African-American, understood this. Women in high tech understand this as well. And many people who have this sense of, do they belong, and are constantly trying to do something to themselves to justify either belonging or what's happening to them. Scott, we talked early at the beginning of this podcast about that picture of my dad and the women there. And I think in some respects, that picture is a great example of what we're talking about right now. That sense of the imposter syndrome, do I belong or do I not belong? You can look at the eyes of those folks and you can see those who think, yeah, I really belong, and those who are questioning that.
Let me ask a hard question that I think this, if someone's made it this far into the podcast, they might be thinking, why does it always have to be about color? Why can't we, quote unquote, just do our jobs? Why is that a, kind of a dangerous bit of dismissiveness, or is it?
Yeah, I mean, and that's obviously a great question. I think it's a question that certainly comes up today more so than it did in my dad's era. And I was writing this book about my dad's era. It would be great if we could be a colorblind society, but we're not there. We're certainly not a post-racial society, even though a lot of people thought when we elected a Black president that would be the case. The truth of the matter is, when you're doing your job and just doing your job, but you're not getting the promotions you receive, you're not, that you should receive, you're having to train people who later become those who manage you. When you look at the diversity or lack of diversity around you, when you look at software and high-tech products released that don't address the needs of everybody, particularly people of color and minorities, then you do have to take into account race. You do have to take into account diversity and inclusion. Simply looking at the products that the high-tech industry generates and their disproportionate negative impact, for example, on people of color, you've got to ask yourself why. But also, more importantly, Scott, I think you've got to look at the steps you can take that might change that. That's what I'm really about. How do we get to that place where we can say we're just doing our jobs, knowing that just doing our jobs means we're going to take into account ways that we don't introduce bias into the high-tech products that we develop?
Which is really to say that we do. The goal is to not be biased, and that starts with acknowledgement that everything starts out biased, whether it is intentionally biased or not.
Right. Yeah, I think the goal is to be able to, in the high-tech field, produce products that are not biased. There are ways to go about that, but the biggest way not to go about that is just to do nothing and to just assume that you're going to generate non-biased code and non-biased products. That is not the case, and we can cite example after example where the software created today, the algorithms generated today, have bias within them, you know, in fact, because the developers who are doing them have their own implicit bias. All of us have this implicit bias. The question is, can we become enough aware of it so that it doesn't creep or seep into the code that we create?
Mm-hmm. There was a letter that Thomas Watson's son, Thomas J. Watson Jr., wrote in 1953 called Policy Letter 4. Tell us what that was, and was that a savvy move, or was that what he believed?
Yeah, so Policy Letter Number 4 is really taken by many people as an important milestone in the diversity and inclusion movement among firms. Policy Letter 4 was a letter that that Thomas J. Watson Jr. sent out to all IBM employees, stating IBM's goal to hire, to promote, not on the basis of race. I think IBM, like any company, almost there's kind of two ways in which you can look at them. One, I think that probably expressed the belief that Watson wanted for his company. But at the same time that was happening, I was there watching my father, again, not getting the promotions he deserved and training people that later went on to become his managers. So part of that is aspirational on the part of IBM. And I have to say that looking at IBM's history, as I do in the book, part of it is also really savvy public relations. IBM and Watson, both the old man, as we used to call him, and the son, were really gifted public relations folks. And so I think you've got both things going on there at the same time.
When your dad was the first, the challenge is not just to be the first, but to certainly remain the first and set up the second, third, and 1,000th up for success. What were some things that he did to set folks up for success so that he was not the first and last?
Yeah, and this is one of the funniest stories I think I tell in the book. Funny because it has to do with my dad's dresser drawer and what I discovered in an envelope beneath his Playboy magazines. So beneath his Playboy magazines, I actually discovered something I think was more risque than what was between the pages of those Playboy magazines. And that was that my dad had bootlegged copies of the IBM entrance examination questions and answers. And he would share those with selected young, mostly black men that he felt deserved a leg up in trying to get into the company. Now, I think this happened after the point that my dad realized he had hit a glass ceiling and was not going to go much further in the company. So he was looking around for ways to help others. My dad also, and I've described him this way a couple of times, my dad was a street fighter in a business suit. And I think he understood that you play this game in such a way that you sometimes have to use the very tactics that are used against you. And that's why he, I think, ran an underground railroad, I think that's a good word to describe it, to bring promising young black men into the company who might succeed and go beyond where he was able to go.
Did that set them up for success, or does that take a risk at, I mean, when you take a risk, when I refer someone to work, I'm doing the best I can to hopefully set someone up. But if they burn me by not doing well, then I'm basically set up the next person for failure.
Absolutely. And I think the answer to that question is yes, obviously it's a risk, but I also think my dad was somewhat savvy and selective in who it was that he tutored or mentored or gave this leg up with. Of course, you have no way of knowing exactly how a person is going to handle themselves, but there was also this kind of code among the first blacks in many different fields who understood the eyes of the world, so to speak, or felt the eyes of the world were watching them. And so there was a sense of, let's say, a little more pressure on them to do well than somebody who isn't the first or among the first in a field.
So people in this instance who were effectively the Jesse Owens of software knew that and felt the pressure of that and all eyes on them to succeed.
Absolutely, just like Jackie Robinson in baseball. And I grew up in an area of the Bronx where there were many firsts in different fields. I would go to my grandparents' house and be introduced to the first black fire department lieutenant and the first black police department captain and the first black lawyer. And so there was a sense in this Williamsbridge community of the Bronx in New York that these was a community of firsts who understood that how they performed would really influence how those who came after them had the opportunity to perform.
Well, thank you so much for chatting with me today, sir. I do appreciate your time.
Scott, this is a pleasure. I am so happy to have this opportunity to talk with you.
You can check out Clyde W. Foer's book, Think Black, a memoir. It's in hardcover now, and you can also get it on Kindle. I'll make sure to include links in the show notes, and hopefully you can see Clyde speaking locally as he continues his tour around speaking about this excellent personal story. Thank you, sir.
Thanks again, Scott.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.